Okay, folks. Again, we apologize for the technical problem, but we are now back, and I will turn it over to Thomas Sargent right now.
Okay, I apologize for the technical problems. Okay, so what I'm going to talk about is the plural of American inflations. And I'm going to talk about North and South. So here goes. My theme is going to be well stated by this quote from John Taylor in the late 90s. Changing economic theories and opinions about inflation are the ultimate cause of the changes in actual inflation. And I'm going to give you two variations on that theme. So my theme is there's going to be theories in play, better and worse, but not perfect. There's going to be learning by the public and by policymakers. There's going to be expectations. You could think of rational as a benchmark, but there's going to be adaptive, 1990s adaptive. In the tradition of a couple of current Fed presidents, Jim Bullard of St. Louis and John Williams of New York, who've done extensive work in this tradition. And then there's going to be temptations, almost a biblical theme of temptations. And the temptations that I'm going to talk about is different temptations in the North and the South. In the North, the stories about the conquests of inflation are going to all be about temptations to exploit a perceived Phillips curve. In the South, it's going to be a temptation to use the printing press to finance government deficits. And I'm not going to put these together until perhaps the very end. So my North American story is based on this, is mostly based on this Princeton book I wrote in 1999 about the conquest of American inflation. But John Taylor and Brad DeLong and Romer, they had related versions of my story, very close to the story. We're all on the same page. So what is that? This is all about the sweep up of inflation in the 60s and 70s, and then its conquest by Volcker and Greenspan and their followers. So here's what the story is going to be. Milton Friedman is going to be, you're going to see he pervades this whole story. It's going to be about inferring an incomplete model of the Phillips curve. It's about monetary policy authorities and taking monetary policy actions based on a model and an incomplete model. It's a non-expectational Phillips curve that they had in mind. It's going to be there then experiencing the consequences of those policy decisions taken with that particular incomplete model. And then it's about using the data that came in when they got those consequences to refine the original Phillips curve after detecting a missing variable. And the missing variable is expected inflation. The same variable that Milton Friedman in 1967 said ought to be in the Phillips curve, but wasn't. Is a very prescient remark, because that's a story. So the components, the theoretical components in the background, there's going to be labor supply and labor demand. There's going to be a family of Phillips curves that are indexed by expected rates of inflation. There's going to be expectations, mostly adaptive, in 1990s adaptive. There's going to be learning, and it's all about the government. This is in the Taylor, DeLong, Romer, and my story. It's all about the government learning about a non-expectational or expectational Phillips curve, coming to grips with trade-offs, if any. And then there's going to be one other force. Okay, so here's a picture. You know, that we teach both the undergraduates and graduates still. So the idea of the Friedman idea was that in truth there exists a family of Phillips curves. There exists Phillips curves, but there's a family of them, and they're indexed by the public's expected rate of inflation. So I've drawn one for expected inflation is low. And so here's the Phillips curve. On this axis is unemployment. Here's inflation. U is U star for Friedman's natural rate. So if you had low anchored expected inflation, you had that Phillips curve, the data would be scattered about that. If you had high expected inflation, it would be like that. That's kind of Friedman's story. So this, you know, just to elaborate on this, if you have anchored expected inflation, if it anchors expected inflation, then I have expected inflation anchored at 0.02. You know where I got that number. That the data would come in scattered like this. And essentially, the gap between expected and unexpected inflation is it's a surprise inflation, and that surprise inflation generates this gap. That's kind of the Friedman, Phelps, Lucas expectational Phillips curve. But now the data look like that, so there seems to be some trade-off, but it's not an exploitable trade-off, and it's only that trade-off if you don't try to exploit it. If you tried to exploit it, expectations of inflation will become unanchored. And if they were totally unanchored, so expected inflation is actually equal to actual inflation, apart from some shocks on average, approximately, then the data would be scattered like this. And it would be a steep Phillips curve. Kind of if I showed you some data, I have some beautiful actual data where, you know, over time, this Phillips curve actually did drift up and end up, oh my goodness, it ended up, yeah, sorry. Okay, sorry. It ended up looking like this. What's the message of this is all about the story is all about the natural rate and surprise inflation. And it's all about the lesson is about the different consequences of anticipated by the public and unanticipated or surprise inflation. With anticipated inflation, there's a vertical Phillips curve and there's no apparent trade-off. With surprise inflation, there's a flat Phillips curve. There's an apparent trade-off, but it's not exploitable. And so this story about the conquest of US inflation is all about, it's all about the Fed and the policymakers kind of groping their way toward a correct view of the Phillips curve that teaches them it's not exploitable, and then bringing inflation down the way Volcker and with some pain with the way Volcker and Greenspan did. There's variations on this story that bring in a bigger or smaller role for rational expectations. But the basic forces are there. So now I want to go to South American inflation. And I'm doing things in what I regard as a Chicago, a Friedman Chicago tradition. I'm going to build stripped down, the work I'm talking about, they're stripped down models that focus on just a few forces at a time and don't put in everything. So in this model, what's going on in South America, this is influenced by Friedman and Kagan's work about the monetary dynamics of big inflations. And they had a couple key elements. One is there's a demand for real balances. M over P is an inverse function of the public's expected rate of inflation. Why? You know, well, if expected inflation is high, people who hold real balances have an incentive to economize on them. But the level of real balances is the base of an inflation tax. So there's a demand function for real balances. That's one component of this body of theory I'm going to talk about. There's a government budget constraint. And the key thing is the government finances a deficit by printing money, uses the printing press. It gives rise to that temptation. So there's inflation tax revenues. Those are real revenues. But now, because of this inverse demand function for money, there's a Laffer curve. And there's a low tax rate and a high tax rate that generate the same revenue. We'll see that. And then the last thing is there's theories of expectations, and partly because of what some earlier speakers talking about, I'm going to use adaptive because this world is going to be sufficiently complicated that that it's hard for people to figure out everything immediately, and we're going to put them in this environment. So that's what goes on. Okay. So with that. Okay. Okay, so good. So what's going to be in play here? It's a term from Stan Fisher. We have this Laffer curve. There's going to be a slippery side of the Laffer curve. I'll show you what that means. And this theory is going to be, it's going to be a fiscal theory of inflation. You know, fiscal in the sense that, you know, Friedman bought it a long time ago. And so we're going to have adaptive expectations in the 1990s version. And the reason I'm going to use adaptive expectations, even though I admire rational expectations, is this is going to support a fiscal theory of inflation. And what I mean by a fiscal theory of inflation now is this simply the idea that bigger sustained deficits, if you run sustained government deficits and you print money to finance them, that's going to bring bigger inflation. That's going to be bigger inflation. And I think of this as the old time religion. Okay. So here's kind of what's the key graph. If I put, this graph's going to underlie the Chicago Friedman Laffer curve, Stan Fisher slippery side of the Laffer curve, fiscal theory of inflation. So what's here? I put a pi te dot. That's the rate of change of the public's expectation of inflation. There should be an e here, and that's a function, this g function, of two things. It's a function of the public's expected rate of inflation, and it's a function of the deficit, which I've just frozen. So I've frozen the deficit. So if you have one level of deficit, persistent deficit, that you're printing with money, there's this curve that tells you the way expected inflation is moving on average if people are using sophisticated adaptive expectations. Essentially, they're just running regressions based on the data that comes in. And these arrows, okay, so here's zero. These arrows are pointing, they're telling you which way expected inflation is going. And so if you notice this graph, there's two zeros. And those are steady state, roughly average tax rates that these dynamics imply. There's this one, which is the low, that's expected inflation tax rate. And there's this one, the high inflation tax rate. So just like, you know, Laffer pointed out in a different context, there's two tax rates that finance the same government deficit with printing money. And this one is stable and this one's unstable. Okay. And I like this one. And fortunately, this adaptive expectations leads to this. And once you get here, this is very close to a rational expectations equilibrium. I'll just say that. Okay. So here's this slide is everything about the fiscal theory of inflation. Okay. So what is, if you increase D, what does this curve look like? What happens to this curve? Well, if you do a little math, and the math just involves take a real demand function for real balances of the kind I said, put in the government budget constraint with printing money, and do about 10 lines of algebra. And you'll find that this curve now looks like this. So if you increase the government, larger D shifts this curve up, and it causes this low, this stable inflation tax rate to rise. And you know, that embodies the fiscal theory of inflation. And this one is the opposite. It's kind of crazy. So that's one reason we like adaptive. That's one reason like Bullard and Williams like adaptive expectations. This isn't the only part time when this becomes a reasonable one. Okay, so now I'm going to lead up to we're going to put this to work to study Latin American inflation. And this is some work. So I showed you that book I wrote, Conquest of American Inflation. I should have titled it Conquest of North American Inflation. So with some pals, we wrote a paper called The Conquest of South American Inflation. And we're using this type of model. So here's kind of the picture. I'm just going to draw this with 1D. Okay, so there's my original picture. And now I've kind of colored this. This is the fiscal theory of inflation stable region. And as long as we kind of the shocks to the system aren't too big, we're driving toward this point. And deficits are why do we get in high inflation? It's because there's big deficits. But then there can be a shocks which occasionally pushes expected inflation kind of by shocks into this region. Well, if we ever got into this region, expected inflation just takes off due to the dynamics of learning itself, divorced from the fundamental causes of inflation. This is when you get into this region, this is Stan Fisher's slippery side. And he was interested in this because he was interested in Latin America. Inflation takes off. Okay, so that's going to lead to an approach to studying South American inflations. So we have this dynamic Laffer curves. There's going to be what I'm going to call a fiscal reform. Is lower the deficit that has to be financed by the Fed or the central bank. Well, fiscal reforms lower the inflation tax rate. They expand this stable region, and they contract this nasty slippery side region. So, you know, fiscal reforms are good, quote unquote, if you like low inflation on all three counts. Okay, so my friends Noah and Tao, this is a Fed project, Atlanta Fed project, the Conquest of South American Inflation. So here's what we did in this paper. We used a statistical model of the type that I just described, you know, with putting some shocks carefully in and data. And then we use it to infer what happened in a bunch of South American countries from their histories of inflation. And we ask what caused inflations to ignite and then to stop. And there could be several things. There could be fundamentals, government deficits financed by inflation tax. That's what we call fundamentals. But there could be some inflations that occur just because of destabilizing expectations and shocks that occasionally divorce inflation from fundamentals. That can happen. And the way it happens is because of this these dynamics I showed you for expected inflation. So that can happen. And they push you into this escape region where you're heading north. And then there's reforms. There's a couple kinds of reforms. And you know, South American history, recent last centuries, pockmarked with reforms that are temporary. So they're fundamental reforms. They reduce the deficit. And there's cosmetic reforms that are trying to reset expectations. How you do that, we could have a conference about that. How do you set at reset expectations if you don't affect fundamentals? Okay, so we did that and used some statistics, mostly Tao and Noah. So we used the model and data together. The data never speak by themselves. You're always using some kind of model. So what we find is for Peru, there were cosmetic reforms, were stabilizing inflation temporarily, and then there were eventual fundamental reforms. We detected those. In Bolivia, fundamental changes, government deficits were the culprit, both for the causes and the cures. Argentina and Brazil, so if you read the paper, we talk, we use the model on all of these. And then in Chile, shock volatilities matter. And so, some people in the last session were talking about shock volatilities in a really interesting way that they had increased. Well, something's going on in Chile anyway. I'm gonna wrap up soon. So you'll kind of notice the following. The common sources of what I'm talking about are Milton Friedman, if we're gonna do a history of thought. Both types of models are intimately connected with work of Milton Friedman and his teachers and students. And some of it's connected with Hayek, because these adaptive models have an evolutionary component that's really important. Milton Friedman did other things about the connection between adaptive and rational. The most sophisticated work about that, and some of it's by Bullard and Williams, by the way, these Fed presidents, the first work on that was put down by Friedman. I'll just say that. I'm going to credit or blame Friedman on this. I've used separate models for North and South, and you'll notice that. And what about general equilibrium theory? Shouldn't everything be connected? So I think of Milton Friedman as both a really good general equilibrium theorist and a partial equilibrium theorist. And he, one thing that marked his work was a flair and a good sense for which pieces of a general equilibrium system should you isolate and which pieces should you put in the background. And you notice I've tried to copy that with a different story for North and South for particular purposes. But now I kind of want to question that.
And Thomas, this is Norbert again. I just, if we can, just trying to wrap up over the next 10 minutes. And then to be mindful of the next panel, we'll probably just skip audience questions.
Okay, good.
We can move into the next one, but.
Okay, okay. Okay, so you and I can talk. So I'm almost ready to wrap up. So now I just want to say, what about U.S. inflation today? So remember, I've shamelessly appealed to Milton Friedman for this two-part strategy, North and South, and separating. And now I want to ask, is that a good idea? So Phillips curve. In the North, demand function for money, different temptations in the North and South. So what about the US today? I wanna just close by reconsidering this, what I call the Friedman isolation strategy. Versus a more general equilibrium approach. So which forces are in play in the United States today? Just the North forces learning not to exploit or how to cope with the Phillips curve as the data on inflation and unemployment come in, and as the curve seems to shift on us, for maybe partly because of things that the authorities are doing, or the South using an inflation tax to finance the government deficit, or are both going on in the United States today? Heaven forbid. So this is, I'm just going to point out, some thinking that I've done with my friend George Hall. We wrote this paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in the spring, published in the spring. And this is about three world wars and monetary and fiscal consequences. And the idea here is we detect patterns that are similar in U.S. participation in three what we call world wars, and take some liberty, World War One, World War Two, and the war in COVID, both of which are associated with big shocks to the labor markets, either in the form of draft or in forms of shutdowns, and big surges in government expenditures. That's kind of a common force. So I'll show you some pictures about consequences. What this is I'm just going to show you some pictures and then stop. Here's the log of the price level from the start of three wars. So the way this graph does is we took the three wars and we had when the war started, and we plot the log. This is the log of the price level. So you see World War One, see World War Two. You can see the price controls in World War Two. So you see what happened to the price level after the war, the log of the price level. Look where COVID hit. COVID's the blue line. And every month, George and I add an observation. And then for better or worse, it's just creeping along and following that same pattern. Okay, so now here's the next thing. And this is going to be a north. Oops, a north. Sorry about this. I need one more. A north start. Darn. Okay, there. Here's how are creditors of the US government doing? So what these are real, and how do they do in the previous wars, big world wars? So the cumulative real return on holding a portfolio of US government debt from the starts of three wars, well, you can see is US creditors in real terms, they did badly. They got negative, they got in net terms, they got gross returns, which were far less than one. And what you'll see is in the war on COVID, this blue line is following the experience of our two wars. And now I'll show you one other, I'll show you my final graph. Okay, what this is the US debt GDP ratio in the 20th century up to very recently. And so what you'll see is after World War One, there was a rundown in debt that was paid for in a certain way. After World War II, it was paid down, and inflation and bad returns to government bondholders was part of the source of that rundown. And here's the war on COVID. And if you'll notice, in the last more than a year, the debt GDP ratio, real debt GDP ratio, has been declining. You could read in our paper what these blue lines, these have to do with repo and paying interest on reserves, but the debt GDP ratio has been declining. And why has that been declining? Well, the US has been imposing an inflation tax, not only on holders of currency, but on holders of US government interest-bearing securities. And that's contributed to this. And now it's kind of a criticism of the whole structure of this talk. I separated it into this north and south. And the question to ask is are some of these experience, I hope it's not true. I hope this last 3 minutes is impertinent. But is it true that some of these considerations are coming into play? And by the way, this inflation tax, it doesn't just redistribute between government creditors and the government. It contributes between private debtors and creditors. I'm done, Norbert.
Okay. Thank you, Thomas. So again, just we're going to forego questions for our next panel, which comes up at 2:15. Thank you very much. And we will be back.